Good afternoon, and welcome to your own Health and Fitness. I'm Health Integration Specialist Lena Berman. I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and integrated health. There are an increasing number of ailments that Western medicine seems to be at a loss to treat. One of the latest and most critical, in terms of urgency, is hepatitis C, which is a viral liver disease that presents sometimes as long as 25 years after an individual is exposed. Now, with the exception in the later stages of the disease, people will live with hepatitis C for a long time without invasive symptoms, but with the exception of really difficult treatments like interferon, which can cause disruptive side effects in some patients, a liver transplant is often expected and even hoped for, so it's a very destructive liver disease. In looking at some of the research, I discovered, not to my surprise, that most of the stuff that's been studied concerning treatments that are complementary or herbal in nature have been done in China with Chinese medicine and Chinese herbs. There are practitioners in the U.S. who are starting to use dietary and nutritional interventions along with herbs to rebuild and protect the infected patient. Today, I'm interviewing nutritionist Robert Crayon about some of the research supporting complementary treatments for hepatitis C. We're also going to try to talk about another crippling condition that seems to defy allopathic medicine, migraine headaches. So let me greet my guest, Robert. Are you with us? Yeah.
How are you?
I'm just fine and dandy. Are you well as well?
I'm extremely well.
You're well? We're both well?
We're both very well.
Okay. Well, let me introduce you to the people who may not have heard you on the show before. Nutritionist Robert Crayon, who has a master's degree and is a, every time I say that, I think of the Fireside Theater, you know, if I'm a scientist, I have a master's degree, I know more than you, is a clinician, he does know more than you do, incidentally, is a clinician, researcher, and educator, who, according to Self Magazine in August of 93, is one of the top 10 nutritionists in the country. I have to agree with that. He maintains a busy nutrition practice in Boulder, Colorado, and he also practices some in New Rochelle, New York, and is a frequent guest on radio and television programs nationwide. He's an author of the best-selling Robert Crayon, and Crayon is spelled C-R-A-Y-H-O-N-S, in this case S, Crayons, Nutrition Made Simple, and has a newer book out called The Carnitine Miracle. These are both published by Evans and company. Robert is associate editor of Total Health magazine, and he's also president of Designs for Health, which is an educational institution established in 1989 that trains healthcare practitioners in the latest findings in clinical nutrition. So welcome to you once again.
Thank you for having me on my absolute favorite health talk radio show in the country.
And that without any bonuses or rebates back in cash to him, he's saying that.
You're my favorite host. You're the most knowledgeable. You do the most work preparing. This is not some rehearsed love fest here. This is not the Barney Show. These are just the facts, folks.
Thank you. Well, speaking of being prepared, I wonder if you have reviewed, because I haven't reviewed all of this, what's available in terms of the studies or the information that's out there about the potential triggers or vulnerabilities associated with hepatitis C infection. I mean, I would think the one thing that's really obvious is if there is liver damage from the past, from alcohol or some other things. But I looked at stuff on the internet in preparation for this, and I have some theories, but I wanted to kind of hear what your feelings are. I also don't know much about the pathogenesis of this disease. So,
well, hepatitis C is quite serious, as are all forms of hepatitis, and it seems to be, in my practice, and I would say about 20% of my patients have hepatitis C, so there's quite a number of them that I'm seeing, and most of them over the phone, because I'm getting lots of referrals from all over the place. And it seems in my practice to be most associated with so-called recreational drug use from the 70s or 80s in the past.
And alcohol.
And alcohol. It does not help it at all. And I remember speaking to some practitioner friends of mine about how many hepatitis C patients I'm seeing, and they go, really, what's causing it? And you know, I almost consider that an invasion of privacy, like hepatitis C, HIV. I don't want to know. It's not really my business how they got it, although in the case of hepatitis C, I ought to know. But, of course, both can be caused by recreational drug use. And so...
Well, not everybody... I mean, the reason I'm asking is because we are seeing an alarming amount of this suddenly presenting. As I said in my intro, this is one of those things where it's like AIDS. You could be infected with it 25 years ago, and then boom, all of a sudden, there you are, you know, with it. And you don't know where and how you got it. It's much more serious than Hep B.
And it is a viral.
And it is viral in nature, which is slightly different. Mm-hmm. But clearly, everyone who was exposed to it didn't get it. And I'm not sure. I mean, are we saying that you never see anybody who led a very... I mean, well, let's be honest. Anyone who's still an adult and not quite elderly who may have picked it up 25 years ago was likely to have made it through the 60s. And actually, there's very few people who didn't at least experiment a little. So are you saying really that most of the population that you're seeing, without being too disclosive, have dabbled? That there is
that seems to be the key. Mother-to-child transmission has been documented, although how much of a risk exists there we don't know. And all my hepatitis C patients are well over 30, so that's probably not the way they got it. And risk factors are still,
because not everybody's going to get it that's exposed to it. Clearly, you know,
right.
You're going to be.
And so there's a lot of questions there. But hepatitis C is very, very serious, because if it isn't treated successfully, be it through alpha interferon therapy or some other medication which may or may not work, and or nutrition, if it doesn't get successfully treated and it progresses, you need a liver transplant.
Right.
And that's very serious stuff. And I think at the very least, my thesis for this discussion will be that at the very least, I believe that we can use optimal and therapeutic nutrition to at least keep it from progressing any further. And I think I can say that with a fair degree of clinical experience with helping these hepatitis C patients. You know,
okay.
whether or not you do the medications, you should really optimize nutrition.
Right.
The great thing about the liver, I know you've got a lot of questions here, but I just want to
I have questions, but go ahead.
The wonderful thing about the liver that I love, and today's trick question is, why is the liver the opposite of your joints? And people are going to think about that.
Oh, I know the answer.
I know that you do. The liver is one of the easiest areas in the body to get nutrients into, whereas the joints are probably the hardest area to get nutrients into because of their unique lack of circulation and other things. That's why when you pull a tendon or you tear cartilage, it's not like muscle that can just heal itself. You're in trouble. Well, the wonderful thing about the liver is the Ellis Island of the body, and if you consume something, it's got to go through the liver. Not almost everything, not absolutely everything, but almost everything not only has to go through the liver, but be metabolized by the liver and be inspected by the liver, and the liver picks it up and says, what is this? Do I want this in the body? No, I'm going to throw you out. I'm going to keep you. I'm going to get you ready for circulation. And the liver is the second most extraordinary thing we have in our body, the first being the brain. This is my personal ranking system. You may have your own. And the best food for the liver is, surprise folks, liver. Now
Before we run full speed at that wall, a couple quick things. One is, another thing that occurs to me about the liver is that, correct me if I'm wrong, please, the other difference, I think, between joints and livers is that joints, I always describe joints as being a non-renewable natural resource, because you're talking about ligaments and stuff can be regenerated to some extent, but if you actually damage the joint structure, there is a point of no return, and that may be true to some extent with the liver, but the liver seems to be something that wants to regenerate if you give it half a chance.
The liver is unbelievable in its ability to regenerate, second to none in any body tissue. You can have a third of your liver left and it can fully regenerate.
Okay.
It's not like the lung, where if it's part of it's gone, that remaining lung tissue will overcompensate. We're talking about new steel girders going up and workmen and...
Yeah, it regenerates.
Regenerating.
And the joints do not. Now... One of the things, I want to talk a little bit about this business of what makes people vulnerable, because there may be people who haven't been diagnosed with it, but who know what their pasts are like and may be thinking, you know, maybe I should be doing something about my liver. One of the things I found interesting as I went through the stuff on PubMed, on Medline, is that clearly if you have a cirrhotic liver, if you have an alcohol-damaged liver, you're going to be at risk. But then there's this very interesting thing that I noticed about iron overload. occurring in patients with hep C. And when I heard that, I thought, oh, wait a minute, iron overload, does that mean that there's an insulin-resistant connection? And I followed that thread and discovered it isn't like a screaming one, at least not according to allopathic medicine, but it is the case that people with hep C, many of them, in fact, are insulin resistant, which is probably because the liver is damaged anyway. So, you know, it's very chicken and egg. But they noticed things like when they were bleeding, for some reason, the iron overload got better because they were bleeding out their iron. Lovely way to do it.
Best way, too, by the way.
It'd be better not to have it happening internally or something, though. It'd be
nice to have it
consciously.
Giving blood.
To give blood, yeah, if they'll take your blood. If you're hep C, you probably don't.
You get a prescription and they throw it away, but if your serum ferritin is over 100, absolutely.
Well, and serum ferritin levels is something that I've noticed that doctors don't want to test for. They want to do all these other hemoglobin, and they get very upset if you insist on serum ferritin. So why do we want a serum ferritin?
Serum ferritin is spelled F-E-R-R-I-T, as in Tom, I-N. Serum ferritin is iron storage protein. And it really shows you your sort of iron net worth, as it were. And you don't want too much iron. If you have a serum ferritin, in my opinion, and based on the research, not just my opinion, but my opinion based on the research, 100 or higher, and this goes for everybody, especially men, because men do not lose blood on a regular basis, neither do postmenopausal women. And those two groups really have to be careful to keep their serum ferritin 100 or lower. Why? Because too much iron is associated, not in every study, but in most of the research, with an increased risk to colon cancer, other cancers, perhaps heart disease, inflammation. And it's not completely signed, sealed, and delivered, but there is enough evidence to suggest that we really ought to keep our iron low. And, you know, as you and I love the Paleolithic model, Lena, isn't it interesting to consider the fact that in Paleolithic times, we probably had a lifestyle that involved a little bit of bleeding here and there. And today, you know, outside of the male shaving ritual and the female shaving ritual.
Or if you are disadvantaged in this country and live in a rough neighborhood, too, I think.
Which is increasingly the case.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's something to keep in mind, that we need to keep our ferritin low so it doesn't cause problems. Let me give you folks a quick book reference on that. There's a book called Iron and Your Heart, which is in paperback, and you can get it all over the place. Iron in Your Heart by Randall Laufer from the Harvard School of Public Health.
Well, how do you spell his last name?
L-A-U-F-F-E-R.
Okay.
Randall Laufer. And it details all the lawsuits that the people like Geritol had to settle in the 60s. When, you know, you read about it there. I don't want to go down that tangent too much further. Fascinating story. And you raise the issue about iron and the liver, and there's no question about it that elevated ferritin is not going to be good for anybody in an immunocompromised state, which is the case with hepatitis C, and also anybody with any liver problems, because the iron is invariably storing in the liver. And when there's too much iron, folks, you rust, basically, is what it is. Now, there might be some biochemists out there who'd say, well, in certain situations, you can have more iron. If you have enough antioxidants, you may be okay. That's true. But I say, why? You know, it's like living right next door to a huge power plant, but you wear a special suit that protects you. Just, why say, move away from the power plant? Even if it might, in some models, be okay, we have enough data to say probably not a good idea to sling a hammock between the power plant, you know, things and sleep there. There's enough data to say it's dangerous. And, again, below 100, serum ferritin and homocysteine, which we know is a marker for heart disease, and we don't want to go into that area right now, but ferritin and homocysteine, if you only had two blood tests, in my opinion, that's what you should test for.
Mm-hmm.
Not cholesterol. And, of course, we want to follow blood glucose as well. But
yes, you would.
Yes, you would. Yeah. You know, you want to test for everything.
Well, those things are very important. Anyway, the other thing that's interesting is that you're talking about oxidative stuff that happens with iron, but there's also, again, going back to it, because I think this will come up again as we talk about diet, the issue of insulin resistance seems to be in here, too, because if you damage the liver, you also damage the mechanisms for controlling blood glucose in your body. And insulin resistance, for those of you who have not heard my show before, because I talk about it incessantly, is the situation where if people are eating a lot of carbohydrate, which gets metabolized as sugar in your body, your insulin levels go up in response to the carbohydrate meals. Insulin is for fat storage, but it also lowers your blood glucose. And if you continually maintain a high level of insulin in your body, it does this thing of making you crave more sugar. You eat more, you get higher insulin levels, and pretty soon your body starts to take the insulin messenger as the boy who cried wolf and rejects it, which means it blunts your tissues to all kinds of hormonal messages and can cause so many problems, the most common of which is type 2 diabetes, but all kinds of hormonal disruptions and everything. Now, so not good connection here. When we start talking about iron overload, iron is a metal. We're talking about oxidative stress, which you described as rusting, and that's a big problem with viral infections of all kinds.
It sure is, and hepatitis C involves a lot of this oxidative stress, a lot of this inflammation, and that's why people with hepatitis C, any form of hepatitis, I might add, hepatitis A and B, always benefit from antioxidants. It's a rule that if you've got any ailment ending in itis, whether it's hepatitis, colitis, bursitis, pancreatitis, prostatitis, you've got something inflamed. What is inflammation? It's very inflammatory molecules being made because, first of all, we're eating the wrong fats. We're eating a lack of omega-3s, the salmon, the sardines, the cold water fish, and flaxseed oil, things like that. But also, we're not getting enough vitamin E, vitamin C, and selenium, the three most important antioxidants we need to consume. And it's really striking in some of these ailments. For example, pancreatitis, they gave patients just a nice high dose of selenium, and it just stopped it. It's really extraordinary what nutrients can do. And in the case of hepatitis, we want nice doses of vitamin C, vitamin E, selenium, and all the, you know, plant-based flavonoids as well. But there is, without a doubt, a very powerful nutrient, the most powerful nutrient in all forms of hepatitis, as well as hepatitis C, very well researched, something called phosphatidyl.
Right, choline. Phosphatidylcholine, and we'll talk about Silymarin too, but again, you're sort of doing your usual thing of just going zoom, and I want to make sure that people are getting this, and I want to unpack it as we go, because this is, people have been really on me to talk about hep C, so I really want to make sure they're getting this. What we're saying here is that one of the goals of using supplementation, and again, going back just for a second, there are drawbacks to the use of interferon alpha. The list of, I have a study here somewhere. In fact, interferon also induces insulin resistance. So boy, let's make these people worse. So the and it also causes, what are some of the other, do you have the other?
Well, the basic problem with alpha interferon is most of the time it doesn't work, but sometimes it does work, and they're playing around with dosing it in higher doses and more frequent therapies, and I'm not a big fan of it, but there are those people who've been helped by it, so it's something, you know, to read about and consider, and it's not, you know, not the be-all, end-all, as you may have it advertised to you by your medical doctor, but, you know, read about it and carefully consider it. There's other drugs that they're working on, but there are antiviral foods that you should be consuming first.
All right, so let's talk about things that you could try before you do interferon, which could cause some problems for you.
If you do interferon, you can do these things at the exact same time.
Of course, so that was the next thing, was is there any problem doing them together? Okay, so one of the things that we're looking at is reducing oxidative stress, because we know that causes all kinds of, you know, it's usual thing, domino theory. This goes down, the next thing goes down after it. Just very quickly, for those of you who may have just tuned in, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm health integration specialist Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with my favorite nutritionist in the world, almost, because I like other ones too, but I think you might still be my favorite, Robert Crayon, C-R-A-Y-H-O-N, author of The Carnitine Miracle, among other things. We are discussing hepatitis C. We're talking about some ways to look at it from a nutritional and supplemental standpoint in terms of trying to boost and strengthen the system instead of just bombarding it with medication, or maybe bombarding it with medication but strengthening it at the same time. All right. So oxidative stress, you go to your the antioxidants and vitamin C, vitamin E, and you're mentioning selenium, which is actually a mineral. But the goal that we're trying to do here is to reduce inflammation and to protect against oxidative stress. So are we through with the things that work the best for that?
Well, that's the good starting list, but, you know,
And we didn't talk about A, because there's the problem with taking too much A in this situation.
Right, you know,
that's an antioxidant.
Vitamin A is a very nice nutrient, as are the carotenoids, but in the case of any liver ailment, you don't really want to dose up on vitamin A or beta-carotene or lycopene or any of the carotenoids, because the liver just really doesn't know what to do with them at this particular time in its life, and it will later, and you can go back to them, but when you have a liver problem, hold the A,
Hold it completely or just take a really small amount of it?
Well, you can eat foods that have it. You can eat liver.
But try not to take it in a multivitamin then.
No, if it's a little in a multivitamin, it might be okay.
Okay.
But most of the times with hepatitis C patients, I don't recommend a multivitamin because you've got so much else going on. You don't have time to play around with the matchbox car supplement of the multivitamin, which is fine for the rest of us, but you've really got to get in there with the power tools. Power tool nutrients and get working. And let me just, for folks that were interested, I've built up to that thing, what's the most important nutrient for the liver? Phosphatidylcholine, I guess we'll go into that, but we mentioned alpha interferon. Well, there's actually a bacteria, a beneficial bacteria that's very effective at raising alpha interferon levels in the body naturally, and that's Lactobacillus brevis.
Oh.
And Lactobacillus brevis is something that you can get in your health food store. And I recommend about 6 capsules a day. Just be aware that it's going to maybe give you a slight fever because it's really going to boost your immune system a lot.
Lactobacillus what?
Brevis.
Brevis.
B-R-E-V-I-S. And Lactobacillus brevis is made by a couple companies out there. You'll have no trouble finding it. It's your Better Health Food stores, and I have no connection with any supplements sold in health food stores, by the way. So, you know, we're not here to do anything but talk science and nutrition to you. So that's a really interesting supplement, and it's very interesting. Quick side note, I have a friend who's a top herbalist, lives in the state of Connecticut, and loves to go out in the woods, and he got bit by a Lyme disease tick.
Deer
and
tick.
He got the fever, and he got the fever, and he's a world-class herbalist. What do you think he did with that fever? Do you think he suppressed that fever? No, he actually took herbs to push the fever higher. And he wiped out the Lyme disease within a day or two, and with a fever of 105. And I said, Donnie, you are the evil Knievel. I don't recommend that for most folks.
No,
what I'm just trying to underscore here is the value sometimes of not, I mean, we don't want 105, we don't want 104, but the idea the minute a body goes to 100, we've got to lower it with an aspirin or something. Hey, you know, there's a reason why the body might be doing it. It's like, you know, I always say it's like the Green Bay Packers. A team comes to play them in the winter. It's the temperature is their advantage when the Miami Dolphins go up to that really cold temperature. And this reverse is true in the body. The body raises the temperature a little bit, makes it difficult for spirochetes and viruses and so forth. So that's just as an aside.
Yeah, don't lower fever if it's like 100 or 100, even up to 102. When you start getting delirious, it's time to lower the fever because you can really bend damage your brain.
Do all this with the guidance of your physician, you know.
Yeah, or a healthcare practitioner
osteopath, naturopath, whoever is guiding you.
Okay.
We're just sharing information here. There's another very, very, very powerful antiviral food that we need to know about, and it's called lauric acid.
Right.
I'm sure Mary Ennick has been on the show talking about it. So if you've got any viral problem, whether it's HIV or you keep getting colds or what have you, or you even have a herpes outbreak a lot of the time, and here we're talking about the virally induced ailment known as hepatitis C, the leading cause of chronic liver disease worldwide, eat coconut, fresh coconut. If you can.
Organic. Spectrum Oils makes now a clean version of coconut oil.
Excellent.
Coconut oil traditionally has been, they use like a cleaning fluid to extract it because they were just using it on your skin. That way, always just using it on your skin. It still goes through your bloodstream. But anyway, now finally people have started clamoring for some organic coconut oil. It's available now. And it is, the best thing to cook in along with butter because it isn't damaged by heat. Yes, my engineer looks confused.
Coconut is so good for you. No, they went down to the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition researchers went down to the Puka Puka Islands down in the South Pacific. And I think if you live on the Puka Puka Islands, you've got to be happy just saying that name every day. I live in Puka Puka.
I was going to say that, yeah.
This is real.
I live in Puka Puka.
And they found that these people were free of heart disease. They had healthy cholesterol levels. And they were healthy overall. And their main food, the number one food, the food they consume more than any other is coconut. And I think it's one of the great foods for a healthy heart in humans. Study does not raise cholesterol, and it either keeps it the same or lowers it. So even flaked coconut is better than nothing. The best way to eat coconut, I think, is sitting on the beach in Bermuda when the guy walks by and cracks it open for you and charges you some outrageous sum for it. But there's a synergistic effect with the water and the sand and the sun, so if possible.
I always ask him if it's organic first, though.
And sure.
Well, it stops him. I can stand there and sort of talk to him.
Yes, it's organic.
Right,
give me the money.
It's very organic.
I do that voice impersonation lovingly. I love the people down there.
Okay. We're getting close to a break, but the two supplements that are the heavy hitters of liver repair and protection are Silymarin from milk thistle and phosphatidylcholine, which is triple strength lecithin. and you've been wanting, you're chafing at the bit to do phosphatidylcholine. So
yeah, that's by far the most important, and I would put right up there lipoic acid as well. So I don't know if I should start my lipoic acid ARIA right now. I mean, my phosphatidylcholine.
Well, we've got about 2 minutes, 1.5 minutes. So do you, whichever one is one
well,
and a half minutes.
Well, phosphatidylcholine. Well, we'll start with that. It's found naturally in egg yolks, which is another wonderful food to eat, therefore, especially if you can't afford supplements, and phosphatidylcholine can be expensive. But phosphatidylcholine is what your liver is made out of. And that is what I love to, that's why I'm a nutritionist and not a homeopath. I love homeopaths, but I don't have the patience or the intuition for it. I love to just put in the body what the body is made out of and let the body fix itself. Consuming phosphatidylcholine is like dropping off lumber and steel and screws and drill bits and stuff that your liver can use to rebuild its very membranes. It's extraordinary. Phosphatidylcholine is, you know, the name phosphatidylcholine is another name for lecithin. And buy the strongest lecithin you can afford. And it comes in soft gels, it comes in granules, it's derived from soy. If you're a vegetarian, you can get the granules, which will be completely derived from soy. And half my time on the phone with my hepatitis C patients is to ask them how much PC they're taking, phosphatidylcholine, and see if we can take more, because the studies show up to 20 tablespoons per day. Thank
yeah,
you very much.
Only, the only problem here is people who are sensitive to soy, who are allergic to soy, which is an increasing number of people since soy has gluten in it, might have trouble with phosphatidylcholine, might not.
Well, hopefully there wouldn't be too much in the lipid fraction, but it
okay.
could be the case. But
right.
in the case, if they were slightly sensitive, I'd say, we'll deal with that later. Let's just fix the liver.
Okay. We're going to take a 30-second musical break. We are talking with I'm Lena Berman. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. We're talking on the phone with Robert Crayon, CRAYHON nutritionist and president of Designs for Health, which is an educational institution, teaches healthcare practitioners about nutrition. We're talking about hepatitis C primarily, and we'll come back and talk more about phosphatidylcholine and Silymarin from milk thistle, which are two very heavy hitters for liver repair and control. We're going to take this little 30-second musical break, go get a glass of water, and we'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with Robert Crayon, nutritionist Robert Crayon, CRAYHON. We're talking about Hep C, and Robert also has a website. It's
DFHI.com.
Yeah, Designs for Health Incorporated, is that
Institute.
Right? Institute. Do it again.
DFHI.com, with three W's before it, of course.
Yeah. Well, in your case, of course. And is there any other, did you want to give out an office number or anything? Or
That's just the best thing.
That's the best thing is just to get you through the Internet?
Yeah, my email is robert@dfhi.com.
Okay, so if people want to email you, it's just add Robert. Robert?
No, just start off.
Robert.
Just robert@dfhi.com, and the website is www.dfhi.com. So very simple.
Yeah, it is simple. All right, so we're talking about phosphatidylcholine, triple-strength lecithin. You need a lot of it if you're a Hep C person. You like it better than Silymarin, which is from milk thistle for some reason?
I love milk thistle. I do not have anything against milk thistle, but there is just nothing better, in my experience, than phosphatidylcholine and lots of it. And they actually have studied it in NK cirrhosis and fatty liver patients. They've studied milk thistle and phosphatidylcholine head-to-head, and they found that in the very difficult patients that the milk thistle really didn't have any benefit, but the phosphatidylcholine did. And that doesn't mean milk thistle doesn't work. It does. It's just when things get grim, and I've been there with many patients when it does get grim, and you really have to, you know, you really have to work hard with hepatitis C. You have to eat a sugar-free diet. Alcohol is not even a word you can say anymore, let alone think about drinking something so irritating as that is to the liver. You got to eat a really clean diet. And then you've got to, you know, eat the liver-supporting foods, the tomato juice.
Okay, well, wait, we're getting ahead of ourselves. Let's finish what we're talking about, which is Silymarin.
Right. I'm getting back to that.
Yeah.
But I'm saying that when it gets tough, You've got to pull out all the stops, and that includes lots of phosphatidylcholine. And I like milk thistle, and I love schizandra along with the milk thistle. I think that's a great synergy. But I think phosphatidylcholine is just another level above it, because it's exactly precisely the molecule that the membranes in your liver is made out of. And after all, we're trying to protect the liver, rebuild the liver. So give it what it's made of. Exactly.
Okay. So spell the other herb that you just mentioned, schizandra.
Okay. Schizandra is spelled, there's numerous spellings. Some people spell it C-H-I-S-A-N-D-R-A, but the most common
spelling... Wait, you did that really fast. C-H-I.
The most common spelling is S-C-H-I-Z as in zebra, S-C-H-I-Z-A-N-D as in David, R-A, schizandra.
So it's a little bit like schizandra.
Something like that, right. C-H-I-Z-A-N-D-R-A.
Right. Yeah, that's how I saw it in the literature. And then Silymarin is spelled like Silly Marin with one Y.
Right.
I apologize to everyone in Marin. S-I-L-Y-M-A-R-I-N.
Right, and that's extracted from the milk thistle.
Plant.
Native American plant, which took the Germans to show us how useful it was. Although the naturopaths in this country have been using it for well over 100 years. So I have a
question about this. I noticed that the Chinese have been doing a lot of research in hepatic disease, liver disease. And they're using various herbs and various things like that. One of the things that can happen in Chinese medicine is that organs can become overstimulated, and sometimes they become overstimulated when they're weak. They're overfunctioning because they're weak. And one of the things that I've kind of noticed with Silymarin is if you don't want to stimulate the liver too much, in other words, I think that there's a point where you can overdo it with these herbs and may have to even take a break. And I've noticed this with diabetics, that on the one hand, you want to repair the liver, but if you overstimulate the liver, then suddenly their blood sugars go up. I've noticed it with people sometimes whose livers are overstimulated because they have autoimmune diseases and inflammation. And if you overdo the Silymarin, it helps at first, and then you can overstimulate the liver. And then sometimes you even get digestive symptoms because it affects the spleen and that affects the stomach. So with herbs, sometimes it's a good idea to take a cycle of them and maybe go off for a while, you know, not just automatic. And that may not be the case with phosphatidylcholine.
Actually, phosphatidylcholine is very gentle. The only downside, with phosphatidylcholine is that it is also such a brain nourishing thing that it will make you remember your dreams or dream more vividly. So if you don't mind that, it's fine. And it's just a marvelous thing. You know, phosphatidylcholine is so interesting because when we take a nutrient, here we are talking about phosphatidylcholine for the liver. By the way, the dosage used, anywhere from 1 to 20 grams in the research, with virtually no side effects. The researchers even note that it's very well tolerated. But thinking globally, thinking about the whole body on phosphatidylcholine is also the precursor for the main neurotransmitter of the parasympathetic, which is the calming down part of our autonomic nervous system. So taking phosphatidylcholine not only helps the liver, but it helps calm you down a little bit, helps protect the body from stress. It has a lot of good things that it does. That's why we like to eat our egg yolks and get plenty of phosphatidylcholine. Phosphatidylcholine is also found in nuts and seeds, but people with hepatitis C and liver problems aren't usually the best at metabolizing and assimilating all of their fats. So, that can be a little difficult for us to say, oh, you want phosphatidylcholine, we'll have some almonds and Brazil nuts. For you and I, that may be fine, but for the hepatitis C patient, that's not really going to work.
Okay, now just before we go on to foods and leave phosphatidylcholine for a second, just to reiterate, have you seen people with lots of food allergies, like soy allergies, have a problem with phosphatidylcholine? Is it sometimes yes, sometimes no?
No, I've never seen it.
Never seen it. All right. So people could certainly try it, even if they're allergic to soy, and see what happens.
Absolutely.
You'll know if you're allergic to it.
Hopefully you won't have a problem.
Yeah. All right. So foods. Now, what we started talking about in terms of dietary changes that protect the liver is the use of lauric acid, which is in coconut, and that's an oil. That's coconut oil, too. Is lauric acid, and then there are other things like omega-3s, which reduce inflammation, which would help here. But these are fats, and you just told us that people with Hep C may have a problem digesting fats.
Well, with lots of fats, I mean the amount of fat that if you take a thousand milligrams of omega-3s in a capsule or something, or you're eating some salmon or even some sardines, usually okay. But I was just talking about laying it on with the nuts and the nut butters. That's such a high fat load that sometimes people with hepatitis C don't do terrifically well with it, depending on where they are in the course of the course, the ailment. But
so it's something to watch for if they have some digestion issues.
And, and you don't want to go too much more than above really 4 or 5 ounces of meat per meal.
Right. That was another question I had, because I noticed that your dietary plan includes, which made me very happy, you know, substantial amount of protein compared to what the American diet is usually like. People usually don't eat any protein all day long, and then they suddenly eat 12 ounces of steak at night or something. And you've got protein throughout the day, which always makes me happy to see. And protein is for repair. I mean, it's what it does, and it has all these neurotransmitters and good things.
It is, but
yes, the issue is going to be in smaller servings, so the liver doesn't have to crank and crank and crank.
Right. There's we metabolize a lot of the protein byproducts in the liver and the urea cycle and other things. So we need to just be so nice to our liver and just treat it royally and just do everything we can to be friendly to it and just give it the Goldilocks amount of protein, which is probably between 6 and 8 ounces of protein a day.
That little?
Yeah, I would keep it.
Jeez, I have people eating more than that usually.
They're probably fine, but just as if I were, you know.
You're talking about a hepatitis C
patient. Hepatitis
person.
C patient, absolutely. You know, the rest of us can do much more than that, but hepatitis C, that's, I usually don't want to go too much above that. But it's patient to patient. It really depends on who I'm seeing. If it's an end-stage person, definitely. If it's somebody who is doing real well, they can do much more than that. And I have seen people beat hepatitis C with nutrition. I have seen it happen.
I believe it. It
doesn't happen all the time, though. Let me tell you. Sometimes we battle for years, and we just keep it from progressing further. I mean, everybody's different.
Well, it's going to depend on how healthy a person you're dealing with initially, too, what you did the rest of your life, too.
Right, and whether they're following the suggestions. You know, we nutritionists have a kind of a joke. We call some clients, and we don't mean this disparagingly, but they are the magician clients who you give a bottle with 60 capsules and tell them to take 2 a day, and 3 months later they're still taking tablets out of the same bottle. You know, it's like somehow it's lasting beyond the point at which it should. Obviously, they're not taking what you suggest, and you know, hey, we're here to work with folks, and I try to be realistic, but hepatitis C, diabetes, and HIV, 3 conditions where you're going to need a lot of stuff, and
yeah,
that's just my experience.
Mine too. Mine too. I noticed that you, again, the inclusion of liver, that feeding the liver what it's made out of, so there's liver. But liver is high in iron.
I think the body can handle the amount of iron that's in a piece of liver, and I'm not saying eat it every day.
Okay.
But there are things in liver, I mean, it's the most perfect food for you if you have a liver problem, isn't it? It's so obvious. You know, the Armenians have a saying that the cure for a disease is always right next to the cause, or something like that. I'm not paraphrasing it correctly, but liver is a phenomenal food. So is kidney. So is heart. I know this sounds disgusting to many people who are just vegetarians who are probably on the verge of eating a piece of lean turkey after listening to you for years, but let me tell you that the organ meats were historically the meats that we ate, and the not the muscle meats, and now it's mostly the muscle meats that we're eating. The organ meats are loaded with nutrients. There are coenzymated.
They have great fats in them too.
They do. There are coenzymated versions of B complex in your liver. There are already metabolized vitamins and minerals waiting there to be used. I have nutritionist friends across the country who say they get results feeding people liver they cannot get with a supplement, and they cannot get any other way. And I respect that enormously.
Why do you have beets in there? I noticed beets in the diet.
Beets contain something called betaine, also known as trimethylglycine, which is very nice for the liver. There's German researchers who have shown the benefits of beet juice on the liver. So if you're somebody who walks by a health food store daily, I suggest sticking your head inside and grabbing a little bit of beet juice with not too much, maybe about 6 to 8 ounces, with some celery and a little bit of greens to balance it out. But beet juice and beets are just
for the liver.
Phenomenal for the liver.
Yeah, and beets are very sweet, so I usually caution people not to get carried away with beet juice, because like carrot juice, like drinking malted.
It's pretty glycemic, but it's so loaded with good stuff that, hey, that's a treat for the day. Some people are going like, yeah, some treat.
Beet juice, yeah, thank you. Yeah.
When you're eating a very healthy diet, it tastes quite good. And it's one small note on beet juice. If you ever are doing a lot of beet juice, and you happen to go for a stool analysis, and they go, and the stool looks red, don't worry, it's not blood, it's the beet juice.
Right. Everything gets red. A cautionary note here, just to remind people, we've already talked about avoidance of damaged or overprocessed fats and foods, foods that contain hormones, and foods that are laden with pesticides. So when we talk about organ meats or meats of any kind, I had somebody call in a different show on the same station and yell at the host about the fact that I suggest that people sometimes look at eating meat I don't insist. And he was saying, well, it's so loaded with all these chemicals and hormones. And well, of course, I'm not talking about commercial meat. Ideally,
you know, you're not going to believe what I'm going to say to you. Even if you can't get that, liver's going to be beneficial. Listen, if I had no money, or very little money, and I'm by no means rich, but I'm doing okay, but if I could not afford organic foods and I had hepatitis C, I would eat the liver at the supermarket. I would have no problem with that. Okay. Is it perfect? No. But, you know, you have to look at the total effect of a food on the body, and liver is very beneficial. And, folks, I don't work for the meat industry. I have no connection. Please don't think that. But I find people to be just a little too philosophical and not scientific enough. If they look at the science and what's there and the benefits of the nutrients in the liver, I mean, it's something you ought to think about. If you're a vegetarian because you love animals and believe in animal rights, I'm not here to change that, but I'm just here to say that I've seen the results, and I can't deny them or keep them from people who...
Well, it's not... If it's a moral decision, that's a moral decision. But if it's a health decision, you should be informed about what you're doing. I get lots of calls from vegetarians who thank me for the information.
Great.
Even though they're remaining vegetarians, which is fine. But they have a better sense of how to protect themselves.
Right. And another food... Let's pick a vegetarian food that I like for the liver, and that's all of your chlorophyll-rich foods.
Greens.
And sometimes spirulina can be a little hard to break down, but if you can afford things like the green drinks, the sugar-free ones, the chlorellas, that sort of stuff. I mean, it's a question of how much money do you have. This stuff's expensive. It's phenomenal for the liver. We could talk a little bit about the coffee enemas, which may gross some people out, but it's actually been used in medicine for 100 years to help stimulate the gallbladder to release toxins and help the liver
like
clean
enemas.
Itself out.
Yeah, but you can also damage the, you know, you've got a terrain or an environment in your colon. And
it's true. This is something you only...
This is one thing that we'll probably disagree on. But,
well, I'm happy to disagree, and I have practitioners who call it their most valuable clinical tool, and I've seen phenomenal results with it, but it's a very case-by-case basis. Some people start overdoing that stuff, and it doesn't help them.
Well, just a cautionary note that enemas can really destroy the... I mean, the colon has a very delicate balance in it, you know, so... the other cautionary note is that we've been talking about individual vitamins, and vitamins work together with other vitamins, so it's a good idea, if you're going to take like vitamin E and selenium, to take the rest of your minerals with the selenium, and to take also vitamin C and your B vitamins with your vitamin E. These things like to be together. They like to work together. So, very briefly, this is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I have on the phone Robert Crayon, C-R-A-Y-H-O-N. He's authored, his first book was called Robert Crayon's Nutrition Made Simple. And listening to him now, it doesn't sound simple, but in a way it is. And it's simpler if you read his book. But there's also The Carnitine Miracle, which is actually a book that was supposed to be titled Stuff I Want to Tell You, is what Robert has told me, which is a book that talks a bit about Paleolithic nutrition, among other things, and does talk about carnitine as a supplement.
Which is a useful supplement in hepatitis C, by the way.
Ah, why?
Because carnitine is very important for the liver to create energy, and it's also very important for our immune system. And a whole other tack that we need to take when going after hepatitis C is not just support the liver, but build up our ability to fight viruses, and there's so many nutrients there. And carnitine is one of them. Carnitine is a very underappreciated immune-enhancing nutrient. It increases immune cell number and activity. And folks, when you're sick, you want lots of white blood cells, and you want them swinging their right and left uppercut and, you know, all that stuff. You want them active. You want them jumping out of the ring and doing a good job defending you. So carnitine used widely in Germany for its immune-enhancing effects, and it's really great for the liver. Another nutrient that's great for the liver is inositol, which we don't talk much about, and it's a nutrient that's really a partner to phosphatidylcholine. Inositol is spelled I-N-O-S-I-T-O-L, and inositol and phosphatidylcholine are wonderful liver-supporting nutrients. By the way, essential for any woman taking any form of hormone replacement therapy.
I actually tried inositol. Inositol, is it not a B vitamin? It's a B vitamin.
It's sort of a quasi-B vitamin.
And it's touted as something that helps with carbohydrate metabolism or something. I felt very odd when I took it.
It can make you feel odd if it whacks the pinata known as your liver and has it detox stuff. I'm not saying that's what happened to you, but it could, because it helps the liver detoxify. Usual dose is around 1,000 milligrams and up, and it's a relaxing kind of a nutrient. And if you get it in the powder form, you take like a...
Some people get buzzy on inositol.
Really?
Yeah. Bodybuilders used to use it before working out. to get a buzz. Yeah, to get a buzz.
It's got mild antioxidant properties. In very high doses, it's actually been used to treat agoraphobia,
ooh,
depression,
ooh,
and
different show.
Yeah, but it's got to be used in 12 to 18 gram doses. So inositol, you know, that's when you need the powder. That's about 4 or 5 teaspoons.
Okay, just before we go off this topic, because we're only going to have like a second to talk about migraines, is that you do have some heavy hitter antioxidants that are not the normal ones, like NAC, N-acetylated cysteine, and lipoic. Now, I always thought that if you take in lipoic, why would you need NAC to get your glutathione levels on? Why isn't lipoic good enough?
Lipoic acid and N-acetylcysteine work through two different pathways to create more glutathione. And N-acetylcysteine just supplies more of the raw material cysteine to the tripeptide known as glutathione, which is such an incredibly powerful body protector, glutathione. Lipoic acid works not through a structural pathway like N-acetylcysteine, but through an energetic pathway to help create more NADH and other compounds, NADPH, that help the body repair lipoic acid.
These are your detoxification pathways, of which your liver is a critical part.
Right. So lipoic acid is extraordinary. Actually, we should quickly mention that Dr. Britt Berkson, who's written a book called The Lipoic Acid Phenomenon or something like that, was kicked off the staff at a hospital in New Mexico because, get this, 6 patients over the course of about a year walked in, actually it was maybe over 9 months, with Amanita mushroom poisoning. And he treated them with injectable lipoic acid.
Because I've heard mostly Silymarin for that. Yeah.
And he cured them.
Oh, that's.
And they were so angry with him because they wanted to form a liver transplant unit that they sent him walking.
Yep. Okay. Coenzyme Q10, another antioxidant, and that one works synergistically with carnitine to help your mitochondria, your energy cells make energy. Another amino acid, a couple of amino acids that are also on here we didn't mention is taurine, T-A-U-R-I-N-E, which is a wonderful one for helping the body fight viruses.
Taurine is great for the immune system, and it's a very underappreciated immune nutrient, so taurine is
1 to 3 grams of that. And lysine, now you've got 1 to 3,000 milligrams a day, 1 to 3 grams a day of lysine. Lysine is famous because it can knock back viral infections like herpes, mm-hmm. but too much lysine, I thought, raised your cholesterol levels a little bit.
Not really.
No, not bad.
I don't think so. I know where you might have heard that, but that's not the best research.
Okay. No, that's fine. And then B12 is an obvious one, you know, and that's important to add in, you know, above and beyond. So 1,000, 2,000 mcgs of that. All right. Can we just briefly, I mean, it's terrible to do a brief thing on migraines, but migraine, I have a family member who has absolutely crippling migraines. So one thing I know about migraines is that they are incredibly different from person to person. Their triggers, their causes, the root causes of them.
First of all, you avoid the tyramine-containing foods, the aged cheeses, the yeasted foods, yeast extracts. You've got to do that first. Avoid chocolate, overripe bananas. I loved it when I was going through a table of all the tyramine-containing foods, and one researcher said, migraine sufferers should never eat banana peel. And I'm like, you know, that's so hard.
I know, to get people off the banana peel.
Please stop eating the banana peel. So any cocoa products got to go.
Any what? Cocoa?
Cocoa products.
Okay.
They all have to go. Beer, and even supplements of L-tyrosine and NADH you should not take because they couldn't play with that pathway. So first you avoid that stuff. But the most important thing after that, no doubt about it, in my opinion, is to clean out the gut, beneficial bacteria, and fish oils. And I have seen that do wonders for folks with migraines. You can eat salmon sardines, or you can take your fish oils a couple grams a day, and your acidophilus and your beneficial bacteria. Antioxidants are important. Migraines are terribly complex, involving a lot of different inflammatory pathways. Folks love feverfew. It's an herb that has gotten a lot of fame for preventing migraines. And if you have a feverfew plant, you can just chew on the leaves. You don't even need to buy the supplement. They found in England that some people dropped out of a double-blind study to go back to eat their feverfew leaves right outside their window because they were given the placebo and knew they weren't getting better. One more really interesting study was published in Cephalalgia, where they gave migraine sufferers 400 milligrams of vitamin B2 all by itself once a day. What did they find? It cut migraine incidence nearly in half. And that's really a remarkable finding. So riboflavin, an up-and-coming B vitamin.
When you say clean out the gut, one of the ways of repairing the gut is what you say, which is the beneficial flora, the lactobacillus and things like that. But the other thing that implies to me is to really be paying attention to food allergies.
Absolutely.
That can be such a trigger.
We just had a conference here with 13 speakers from all over the world, and all but one of them talked about leaky gut trigger for multiple sclerosis, scleroderma, you name it. So absolutely.
Leaky gut, for those of you who don't know, is a situation where the gut lining has been compromised either by the use of too many antibiotics as a child who didn't have too many antibiotics. Any number of other things that are intrusive to the gut lining that you can possibly imagine, parasitic infections, just a diet that's raft with food allergies that are irritating your gut, any number of things like that. People with autoimmune diseases often have guts that don't work very well. Then the mucosal barrier is weakened and little microscopic particles of proteins get through into the bloodstream, and then you have antigens against them, so you're all allergic and crazy and your gut isn't working right. That's the 30-second explanation of leaky gut.
That is it.
Bad news. So, yeah, and then there's a glutamine, which helps to repair the mucosa, which is an amino acid that also helps people not crave sugar because it attaches to the part of your brain that goes, sugar goes here, and says there's sugar here. So glutamine repairs the gut and helps the brain and the sugar cravings. The weird thing about migraines is this business of do you vasodilate or do you vasoconstrict? Because one causes migraine. Somebody's magnesium, you add magnesium, which is a vasodilator.
Well, I think
they feel better. The other one gets a headache.
I think, and forgive that ringing phone in the background, I think that's probably, in my opinion, pretty much vasoconstriction. That's my opinion about it.
Is better?
Well, no, I think excessive vasoconstriction can be a cause.
Too much coffee?
Too much foods that don't have omega-3s in them. I'm kind of a broken record, aren't I?
Too much calcium, too, I would think.
Yeah, a lack of magnesium is never a good
low
thing.
Magnesium.
The bottom line about migraines is that people go to the doctor, and the doctors never talk to them about nutrition.
Nope.
And they're just put on the,
amazing things. And then at the end of all of this.
And that's it. And there are so many other treatments.
Yep.
Migraine drugs, I don't think we need them 99.9%.
Well, this family member of mine went to a specialist for years and years and years and was put on every conceivable type of scary medication you can imagine, anticonvulsants and, just amazing stuff. And at the end of all of this time, he said, these aren't going away. You're not going to be able to get rid of these. They'll probably disappear when you're 70. It's like, good. Thank you very much for that piece of information. I'll send your check in the mail. All right. Well, we're just about out of time. Why don't we give out your website address and your email once again?
Okay. DFHI.com, Designs for Health Institute is what it stands for. That's the
www.dfhi.com.
That's my research company. We train doctors and other healthcare practitioners, nutritionists, chiropractors, etc., in the latest findings in nutritional medicine. We have a lot of fun doing it. My email, which may take me a week or more to answer since I get 30 emails a day, is robert@dfhi.com. Pretty simple.
What if someone, can somebody reach you that way if they want to make an appointment
they
with you by
that.
Phone?
It's really the best way to reach me because if I give out the phone, then I won't.
You won't answer. Won't be able to answer at all.
I'll not be able to pick up the phone. Maybe. But it's fun to get people well. You're a lot more powerful than you think you are. And let me tell you the story of a friend of ours who has migraines. Went to visit the doctor, and the doctor, she went with her husband, and after the session was over, she was telling the doctor all this stuff, and the husband said, he said, I don't know whether you went to the doctor or he went to you.
Yeah, no, I have that experience all the time.
But they're open-minded, and I think they're beleaguered with all the managed care stuff. I'm bullish on doctors. If only they would, take some postgraduate education in nutrition, then they would find they could heal people tremendously.
Oh, having them study nutrition would be amazing. The other thing that would be amazing is if they even had time to read studies.
Well,
even just read their own journals.
I was in the medical library today, and I did spot a couple of medical doctors
there.
So
there we go.
Hats off to them.
Okay, we're just about out of time. I want to really thank you again, as usual, for coming in and by phone in this case, and just really setting us straight on a lot of things and wealth of information. Thank you very much, as always.
Thank you, Lena.
Robert Crayon, CRAYHON, nutritionist, president of Designs for Health Educational Institution. His latest book is The Carnitine Miracle, which is about all kinds of stuff, not just about carnitine. I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or you want a CD copy of this or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours a day at 707-874-2772. For a list of other available shows, information about guests, and news about the nonprofit and the benefits of membership, go to the website, yourownhealthandfitness.org. Your Own Health and Fitness is a joint production of Your Own Health and Fitness and KPFA FM. The engineer for Your Own Health and Fitness today is Mick Mylan. Remember, being informed not only protects your health, it protects your freedom.